In 1989, an 11-year-old girl was raped and was strangled to death by this killer's apartment complex. His sister snitched him and arrested him, and he got sentenced to death by the firing squad. Today, I'll discuss the killer himself, John Albert Taylor. This is Cases of the Crimes. Good evening, guys. Welcome back to another episode. I am very excited for you to, do this episode with you all. But this one's gonna be a little bit dosy, but this is gonna be quick. It's gonna be the quickest episode that I can get here. Yeah. This is going to be the quickest episode that I could do. I mean, not a lot of information right here, so this is really cool. Today, we're discussing some background on what he was, and then we're coming to the murder of an 11-year-old. Her name is Charla King, but we'll get to that stuff later, okay? Yep, some background, some murder, and always execution by the firing squad. We'll talk about all the stuff in details, okay? Alright, cool, fantastic. So, are you ready to do this episode? This is gonna be a very quick one. Won't be a lot of stuff here. Nothing too surprising or anything like that, but let's do this. Okay, here we go. John Albert Taylor. Alright, John Albert Taylor was born in Ogden, Utah, on June 6, 1959, by his parents, Albert and Gaylene Taylor. They were separated when he was born. And he had moved a lot of times when he was a kid, including moved to Colorado at 9, when he was told that his father died, which is Albert. And according to him, he was raised in Florida, where he was abused as a child and became involved in drugs by his teens. Oh my goodness. At an early age, he was abused and had a little drugs. But teens, that did not sound good. That's just started right at the bat right there. My God. And then he stated that he didn't get along with his stepfather, which is a Vietnam veteran, or his mother. And according to him, he said, "But she could never control me. My mother had a lot of animosity toward my father. They alienated me for a long time. I was whipping posts." Oh my goodness, this little abuse thing and also drug that caused him a lot of trouble during the teens when he was being a kid, like 9 years old. Man, this is a lot of trauma for that one. A lot of problems with the family. Oh, that didn't sound good, right? No, it doesn't. At age of 13, he stabbed his stepfather. Holy what? Well, that's the start of his arrest now. Of becoming arrested. Jeez. Alright, according to the records, he raped and sodomized his own sister. Remember, her sister is Laurie. Okay. Why did you rape his own sister? This is gonna be some incest stuff going on right here. But his sister is going to be the foreshadow of this one, okay? It's gonna be a little foreshadow here. Wow, during the teens and rape and sometimes other girls. It's not just his sister, other people. And he was committed to a sex offender program. Now he becomes a registered sex offender, right? At an early age. Goodness. Alright, in 1974, he moved back to Ogden to live his grandmother, but they returned back to Florida again. Oh my goodness. It's totally ridiculous. And in 1977, this is years later, he was arrested in Florida and charged with burglary and carrying a concealed weapon after he was caught with that little stolen gun. He sealed the gun and then he was caught. And he was convicted in prison until December 1901. That was his first arrest before. And he was released on the parole. And then, not very long, 3 months after, he was arrested again for another, for burglary, again burglary, armed robbery, and sexual assault. He had done a lot of those. He'd been diagnosed as a remorseless pedophile. Yeah, I mean, this teenager almost become an adult wanted to have sex with someone. And this, that trauma still keeps going at it on him. Jeez. And he was acquitted of the charges on 1982, was sentenced to 15 years in prison for violations in the parole. That stuck, that whole thing. And then in 1989, he was released and departed from Utah to be with his sisters and biological father. Because they thought that they're alive. We discovered he was still alive. Still alive somehow. So according to him, on March 7, 1992, he said, "From all I saw, my father was a good man. But while I was growing up, I was told so many stories about him that I've come to learn were all lies. My father was being painted to the villain when he really wasn't one. I've come to learn that the real villain was my mother." Well, what did your mother do to you? I mean, he cares about his father, but he hates his mother. What did that mother do to you? Lately, what did that mother do to you? I'm asking that a little question about that. I mean, this is mother really cared about his father, or does he like him because he was the problem? This relationship is not going elsewhere before they was born. This is just a way beginning to that. That was something going on. That was so insane. Okay. Here we go, guys. This is the murder part. This is the part where it is. This is like the biggest hit right here. I told you, I remember, this is going to be a very quick episode. This is going to be very fast. So, here it is. At around 3:20 p.m. on June 23rd, 1989, Sharon King returned from work to her apartment in Washington, Terrence, Utah, okay, to find the body of her daughter, Charla King. So, Charla King was her daughter. In the bedroom with a nightgown around her head and the panties stuffed in her mouth. Oh my god. And after the call, she was instructed to perform CPR, the cardiopulmonary resuscitation CPR, and discovered that she had been strangled to death with a telephone cord. You know that the telephone cord that has like a very loop stuff there. It was attached to the hand phone. It was strangled dead by that telephone cord. Oh, how lethal for that telephone cord is. Won't be doing that. So, her grandmother, Bertha Poster, stated that she had dropped Charla off the apartment at 1:30, okay, after visiting the mall. And then she had been planning to celebrate her 12th birthday. Oh, what? On the next... She was supposed to be celebrating the 12th birthday and then the music part on the next day. But not for this person here. So some of the prosecutors now believe that Taylor entered the house with unsexually molesting the girl. Oh, God. And then when she caught in the house, and then the prosecutors believe that he chased her to the bedroom and placed her underwear in her mouth. He raped her and placed a nightgown over her head and strangled her to death. Holy God. Man, that's... Yep, that's that. That was... Well, her mother came home from work. And then he realized that her daughter was strangled to death. Either the nightgown or the telephone cord. That's so awful. He needed to put the panties in her mouth and trying to... Man, he... Nothing but being a pedophile at this point. No, he really is a pedophile. Because he was abused time from his past, and now he's gonna put that one on this girl. That's so awful. That's a really awful thing to do. Alright, let's get to the arrests here. And on June 25th, a tipster, later to be his sister, Laura Gailey, that's her sister, I told you we'll come back, they contacted the police officer, Marsha Gattacole, with the information that it connected to the murder. So his fingerprints were found on a telephone in King's residence and matched the record provided in Fort Lauderdale. Okay. And then he was arrested about 9 p.m. on June 20th at the home of his half-sister / incestuous lover. Ugh, incestuous is a very good word. Fall in love with another family member. Tressa Taylor. Jeez. In Ogden, Utah. And he was charged a first degree burglary, yeah. First degree child rape and first degree murder the next morning. They're all first degree to us. Okay. So, first degree everything. So, he had arrived from Florida 4 days before the murder. And staying with another sister. Yeah, because he has a lot of sister in Florida, just so you know. So, he said, I remember telling my father that whoever they arrested for this crime was history. And that was before my arrest. Yep, the moment that you knew about this is your sister. Yep, she ratted you out. And from the past, you had sex with her. What in the insensitive hell is this? Yes, I keep repeatedly saying incest. My God, this is so awful. So, Sharon King, all right, this is Charles' mother, moved out of the apartment on June 20, and she was upset that the entire neighbors who came forward as witnesses and had nothing to do when her daughter was screaming. I mean, are those walls thin or what? Yeah, she blamed him and she blamed other people in the apartment, saying that she nothing to do. And she heard when they could have hear her daughter screaming. Like, well, they had nothing to do with it. I mean, it's really the sad part. This is the saddest part. That I ever witnessed this. This is really sad. I know this is a really sad part. What a mistake. This is such a shame. They never done it. They haven't done anything. This thing. Stupid. Okay. Let's get to the murder trial. Okay. On June 27, 1989. The trial commenced under David Roth. The judge David Roth. After he waived his right to a jury. And he testified on his own behalf that he entered on some burglary while nobody was home. And leaving fingerprints on the phone and found money underneath it. We have a deputy attorney, William Dane, stated that he denied being in the apartment that the two says placed him in the scene. At that little crime somewhere. And one of his inmate, Mike Gallegos, testified he had a brief conversation in which Taylor had told Gallegos that he killed a girl by accident and then baited on the... What the frick is that? I'm not gonna swear, though, but... What the frick? You did a what now? You masturbate on... You jack off to a core... To a dead person? What in the hell? What's happening here? Oh my goodness. Okay, let's move on here. Dwayne Moyes and Gaskill. Okay. It testified that the person who cut the tail cord with the knife and then just wrapped it around in the neck of the victim was like the same as the one by fingerprints in the phone. So, okay. So he cut the phone wire from that little big telephone and then she wrapped it around Charla's neck and strangled her to death with that cord, a telephone cord. My goodness, yep, that's the one that we saw. The one that I said that he was strangled to death. And there's this telephone cord that he cut it out and was strangled into that. Okay, that's what it talks about. And then Gaskill stated that the prints, three of them, which were matched to Taylor's left hand and were the only evidence that at the crime scene, the place that he had. No, the crime scene there. And then he also said there was no evidence indicating a burglary took place or any person was connected to the murder. So there's no evidence about the burglary or anyone connected to this, no, the murder of this one. Oh my goodness. Wow. Okay, so in December, on December 5th, Roth found Taylor guilty of first degree child rape and first degree murder of Charla, whatever, Nicole King. And then during the penalty phase of his trial, his half sister Leslie Beal from Florida testified this harsh treatment under her stepfather and the 3 years that he spent in the sex offender program at the Florida Mental Institution. And on December 19th, yep, he became the first convict in 40 years to be sent to death row by Weber County Court. So the judge said that the facts of the case outweighed the mitigating circumstances there, so he's on the death row, baby. So his father, Albert, attended most of his son's court proceedings until he died of a heart failure on October 8th of 1990. And he was not permitted to attend the funeral. I don't know if he doesn't love him that much or anything, but yeah, he attended a lot of his until he had like a heart failure. I'm really so sorry, but I'm not sorry about what you did though. I mean, I'm really sorry about your father, but I'm not sorry about you. So, oh well. And then the case was already automatically appealed at the Utah Supreme Court and would upheld his conviction and was sentenced to on October 1991. And his execution was supposed to be scheduled on January 15, 1992. It was scheduled again on June 24th when his attorney, Martin Gravis, requested to withdraw from that case. And then on June 17th, the judge granted the stay of execution. After this new defense attorney, Ron Yengich, requested more time to prepare some of the appeal. And there's that new 1992 law somewhere in Utah that established a sentence of life imprisonment. Life in prison without possibility of a parole. They were trying to, you know, find the rest of them. And while incarcerated, was in jail, he kept busy after to overcome his, you know, claustrophobia, doesn't like being close things, and boredom. Yeah. In earnest, at least he earned his high school diploma and said to become a paralegal until his grant money ran out. What did you do with the money? I think wasting time with everything, I don't know what. And in October 1995, he decided to end those further appeals at the court, and then after the court rejected this argument and it was ineffective, so he fired his attorney Brastain if I don't fight my appeal, I don't need an attorney. And then he also said that he prepared to that partially because of the failing health, whom like the enlarged heart, and the heart is getting bigger, bleeding ulcers, and swollen legs and feet. Yeah, to end the appeal, but after he got rejected, this is not the argument, but yeah, did not go so well with the attorney and stuff. So yeah, one of his things said, I don't want to die alone in my cell. Yeah, that's exactly what he said. That was 1995. And then he ordered, okay, and then the judge ordered Taylor to choose a method of execution. So he decided to choose executed by a firing squad to make this process a little difficult for the officials. In some of the interview, okay, he stated this, I didn't commit the murder and I'm not going to submit to letting them kill me on that table. And then regarding the option of the lethal injection, like some people do, like McVeigh and some other people, he said, I don't want to go flipping around like a fish out of water on that table. He doesn't really like to get injected like everybody else does. He doesn't want to. But his option is an option of getting executed by a firing squad. I don't know what his intentions are, but that might be his end. Alright, so another one of these quotes here said, to be strapped to a table and inject full of drugs leave me with a feeling of helplessness because I am innocent of the crime for which I was convicted of. Wait, doesn't want to have that little injection on him. Anyway, if my execution is carried out, it will be a murder. Granted, it may be legally sanctioned, but nonetheless, murder will be. And the firing squad is my way of showing that point. And because of the cost and the inconvenience, it will cost the state because they are not really prepared for an execution by firing squad. Well, that's his reason. That's his reason of how was he going to execute it. And that's why he chose getting shot by the firing squad. Well, that's his option. That's what he wanted to do. He doesn't want to get strapped and get injected full drugs. That's like too obvious for him to do. But he wanted to make it a little more difficult for the state. He wants that. He wants that option. After all the time that he had been raped by even his own sisters. Oh my goodness. And murdered an 11-year-old girl without knowing them. Alright. For his last meal, he ordered a large ambassador pizza with thin crust, onions, mushrooms, hot pepper, sausage, pepperoni, and sweet. This is everything. He also asked for a coke when Taylor ordered last meal pizza with everything. He ordered this a piece of pizza with everything on it. And then some law enforcement called that the same request also made by Barton K. Kirkham. Okay. And his last meal to be. And just like him, he had selected the method of execution with the goal of inconvenience in the state. I think he wants the execution firing squad as well for Kirkham. Yeah, definitely for sure. And then on January 25th, 1996, finally has time to spend an evening sharing the pizza with his uncle, Gordon Lee, who had been joined by the former attorney, Brass, okay, and Catholic priest, Reyes Rodriguez, who administered the last rites, okay. And then later, and then Taylor, whose stomach had been doing little flip-flops, yeah, requested some antacid medication and declined deputy warden, while he offered some more pizza and soda and coffee because his stomach has a little thing. Am I? There is an existence called a GERD. If you don't know what a GERD is, it is a, you know, if you know what a GERD stands for, that's like your stomach stuff. It is gastroesophageal reflux disease, or they shorten it for GERD. A GERD. So it's a digestive disease in which stomach acid or a bile irritates the food pipeline when you trying to swallow. That's your esophagus, and then just onto the little stomach, but the acid's definitely going up, and that, yeah, your stomach had an acid, okay, as a little bit, as it had a little trouble to go up on your esophagus. Yeah, GERD, G-E-R-D, GERD. So yeah, no pizza, no soda, coffee, nothing. And he gave his glasses to another warden, Hank Galletta, and said to him, there's no need for them. He doesn't need the glasses anymore. And then he refused to be sedated before the execution, but he was allowed his first cigarette in 6 years. Man, 6 years? That was 1990. That was 1990. He never had smoke a cigarette, but he'll have his one last cigarette. There's the little song there called One Last Cigarette. Okay, so we have the five police officers who have volunteered to carry this little execution, and they were paid $300. Huh, $300. Cool. So the shooters were using the Winchester Model 94 rifles. So one official selected each rifle at random and handed them to another official sitting in the small room. Okay, and the second prisoner then loaded the rifle and returned it onto the table, and then the four of them were loaded with the live ammunition. There's ammo on it now, and then one chosen was located with a wax bullet, and another officer was certain that they fired somewhere in there they shot, and the non-lethal cartridge was tested to ensure the report and recoil were difficult to distinguish. One of those is like a real cartridge somewhere right there. Yep, and then this was located at the warehouse at the Utah State Prison at 12:03 a.m. but we'll get to those details. Let's see here. So there's a lot of news and crews around the world reporting on this execution, and was set up inside this warehouse at Utah State Prison in Draper, Texas. And then lots of meat witnesses. There's a lot of people all there. And there's an actor and activist, Mike Farrell, as a commentator for this American Civil Liberties Union opposition to the death penalty. We have Elliot King, the uncle, was the only sole member of the victimhood to arrive as a witness. He expressed that he had no sympathy for Till. That's good. And then Sister Helen Bajon wrote Taylor a letter. It was delivered right before was the execution. That's where all things happened. And then shortly right before midnight, Taylor was led into the execution chamber and strapped to a chair 17 feet away from the shooters with a hood covering his head. And then there's a lot of bright lights covered him, showing them. And then the sandbags were arranged behind them to prevent any ricochets or something like that to prevent. And the captain walked down the aisle, taping each shooter to the shoulder to check to see if they are ready, to make sure the shooter and the rifles are a little ready to go. And around 12:03 a.m. it's in some Mountain Standard Time. On January 26, 1996, every shooter fired at the count of five, and the white glove target on his chest flew off, and his chest moved upward, and His left hand tightened into a fist. His grip gradually loosened, and his head fell back. And the doctor checked his neck for a pulse and cut two holes in it, so to check for a pulmonary light reflex somewhere. And yet, Taylor was declared dead at 12:07 a.m. And now he becomes the 49th person to be executed in the state of Utah since 1852. That was a long time ago. And this is his final words, like few minutes before got shot in death, the 6 minutes before he died. "I would like to say for my family and my friends, as the poem was written, remember me, but let me go." Yep. 6 minutes before he died. Alright, let's get to this aftermath, and we're ending right here. Okay, so after an autopsy, his remains were cremated and shipped to his uncle, Gordon Lee, in Oregon. And the Salt Lake County Sheriff's Office said it would specify homicide as the cause of death on his death certificate, because the incision met the state's definition of death by another's hand. That's what we're explaining here. And then this commemorative coin was created to recognize the side who had participated in the execution. And then 8 hours after the execution, the Utah State Representative Sheriff Allen first introduced a bill to eliminate the fire squad. So this will be the only time that they want to execute the fire squad. This will be the only time. So his representative Sheriff Allen decided to get rid of the fire squad completely. And then the bill was succeeded in passing the HB 180, which removed the right of condemned to choose their method of execution after February 24. So he has, let's eliminate, and now succeeded date now has to remove it. So that means, yeah. So Sharon decided to pass the bill where remove the right of the condemned to choose the method. So the people who convicted know this murder, they do not have the right to choose which execution they want to do. It's not up to them anymore. After February 2004, they don't have to do that anymore. So, her word said, if they choose the firing squad, it's one last magnificent manipulation of the system to bring attention to themselves. It's time for Utah to do away with the firing squad. Yep, this is the only time that they're gonna have to execute with the firing squad. And yep, John Albert Taylor did it. Taylor did it. He did that. And that will be the last time they're gonna do the firing squad in Utah. And that's it. Nothing else. Whew. That's pretty much it, guys. That is everything. And I told you it's gonna be quick. Well, not actually that quick. It is. It is that quick. It's around 30 minutes. It's not going to be an hour episode or so. That is pretty much it. Whew. We had a lot of things to cover, and we are done. We are done with everything. Man. John Albert Taylor had done a lot of incest things and murdering. No, and rape other people. Other girls was young age, and then he accidentally killed one person, 11-year-old. It's not his apartment complex. Someone came to the apartment complex and died and just strangled this person. That's just one person. Whew, wow. This was something that I was not expected to, but that's pretty much it. Yeah, that is the end of that episode. I told you this is gonna be a very quick one, and it's not gonna be a lot. It's just half part. It's just the background. And the rest of it is just now the murder. No, the execution and how he decided to do. Yeah, that is pretty much it for the Cadence Crimes. Well, thank you guys so much for listening this episode, listening to this podcast. I will see you next time with another case. And find out who will be sitting here and talk this person out. See about their lives and all. Alright guys, goodbye and take care.